This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The president's supreme nominee, the speaker's trip to China, Senator Burris, caught on tape, and the governor's race in New Jersey gets ugly. It's Wednesday, and time to nominate our own political junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
Every week, Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, joins us to talk politics and a little trivia. Congress is out, but there's plenty to talk about. Fresh transcripts show that now Senator Roland Burris promised to personally do something for then-Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich and mentioned, you know, I'd really like that Senate seat. The Senate Majority Leader, the senior senator from Connecticut, and New Jersey's governor all face re-election challenges. And before she dons the long black robe, President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court faces a high-stakes game of jeopardy with the media and the U.S. Senate. We'll hear inside tips for the nominee from a former White House chief of staff. But as always, we begin with a trivia question. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us here in Studio 3A. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Neil. Well, you mentioned earlier in the show that President Obama's in Las Vegas. He's campaigning not only for Sonia Sotomayor, but also for Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, who's in a tough battle for re-election against a still unknown Republican opponent next year. So anyway, the question is, given the Harry Reid situation, who was the last Senate Majority Leader to be defeated in his bid for re-election?
So if you think you know the answer to the trivia question, the last Senate Majority Leader to be defeated for re-election, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk at npr.org. The first to weigh in with the correct answer, of course, wins a fabulous no-prize T-shirt.
Incredible.
Incredible shirt. Yeah. Just the nicest shirt ever. Anyway, getting back to, Judge Sotomayor, who hopes to be Justice Sotomayor, we've heard, universal praise, I think, from Democrats. I guess the question was whether Republicans would stage a filibuster to protest or to try to block the nomination today. Jeff Sessions, who's the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, well, he didn't sense that there's a great feeling for a filibuster, but he did say she does have problems.
We need to inquire into that and give her a fair opportunity to explain it, but on its face, that's very troubling. A judge must submit themselves to the law and be faithful to the law and to serve under the law. They're not above the law.
And Jeff Sessions will, of course, play a role, but Democrats have a big majority on the Judiciary Committee.
They do, but even if you go back a few years when then President Bush nominated Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court, the Republicans did not have a big majority, and Democrats still tried to push through a filibuster backed by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and John Kerry and Ted Kennedy and all those guys. But ultimately, that failed by 75 to 25 votes. So it's very hard to muster up enough votes to stop the proceedings. Plus the fact that even if the Democrats don't have 60, we're still waiting for that Minnesota Senate seat. We haven't mentioned that in a while. But if they still have 59 seats, including Arlen Specter, they still have seven Republicans who voted for Sotomayor back in 1998 when she was elevated to the second court of a circuit court of appeals.
In a long, drawn-out and controversial nomination.
That's right. But Dick Lugar, Susan Collins, Olympia Snow, Thad Cochran, Judd Gregg, Bob Bennett of Utah, and Orrin Hatch of Utah all supported Sotomayor in 98. That doesn't mean they're going to vote for her for Supreme Court justice, but there are some Republicans, certainly the two women from Maine, seem to be inclined to go along with this nomination at least.
And some are saying, look, in terms of her personal story and in terms of her ethnicity, the first Latina to be nominated to the Supreme Court, it's going to be difficult for Republicans to stand in her way.
It is. It's hard to stand up to any kind of a good story, and anybody born in the Bronx, I think, deserves to be on the Supreme Court.
Of course.
By the way, I was born in the
Bronx. I just went to high school there.
Yeah, okay. But also, I mean, she has a great story, her family, her, you know, and the fact that she rose through Princeton, through Yale, and obviously got kudos from everybody she worked with, was nominated by President Bush, the first President Bush in 92, elevated by President Clinton in 98, so she's there. But there's also almost a dare by the White House saying, I dare you to vote against a Latina and the first Hispanic woman on the court. So, of course, if the Republicans are trying to make inroads with women, with Latinos, do you dare vote against them? That's almost what Chuck Schumer dared the Republicans to do. They oppose this nomination at their own peril, he said yesterday.
And of course, one of the states where this has been playing an enormous role is, well, out in the Mountain West in Nevada, where Hispanics are a more and more important part of the constituency. We mentioned Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, facing some difficulties there politically. And last night, President Obama was there to help him with a fundraiser. That's where he was talking about Judge Sotomayor. He's got another fundraiser tonight in Los Angeles. But this is what he had to say last night when talking about the embattled Harry Reid.
In the last few years, Harry's done an extraordinary job as the leader of the U.S. Senate. And that's not easy, by the way. One of the last majority leaders wrote a book titled it, Herding Cats. Herding Cats. And that's what dealing with the Senate is all about.
I think it was actually herding cats.
Well, you know, actually, speaking of herding, Harry Reid has never been popular in Nevada. He is obviously well-respected by many of his colleagues in Washington. But the numbers, the last poll I saw in Nevada says that more people, nearly 50%, said they would not vote for him for another term. Now, of course, you have to beat somebody with somebody. And so far, the Republicans don't have a good candidate or a candidate yet to oppose Harry Reid. But he is in trouble back home. Other people who are also interesting to watch, John Kyle, John McCain, Republicans in Arizona, both of whom voted against Sotomayor in 98, with a big Hispanic presence in Arizona. That's something to watch as well.
John Kyle has been the one most outspoken about perhaps staging a filibuster to oppose the nominee to the United States Supreme Court. Harry Reid in some political difficulties. Also, the senior senator from the state of Connecticut in some political difficulties.
Well, there's a new poll. I mean, he hasn't been in trouble. There's a bunch of reasons why he's in trouble. Brian Naylor of NPR did a very nice story the other day on his Chris Dodd's woes, first elected in 1980. But everything from protecting AIG executive bonuses to an alleged sweetheart deal he got with Countrywide Financial to this apparent villa he owns in Ireland to some bad feelings about moving his family to Iowa.
For running for president.
So right now, the last Quinnipiac poll shows that Chris Dodd has maybe is trailing his Republican opponent, Rob Simmons, the former congressman, but that gap has narrowed over the last couple of months. Still, that election is a year away and plenty of time, I suspect, for Dodd to come back. I think Harry Reid is in more trouble, actually, than Chris Dodd at this point.
Well, let's move on. We've got some people who think they know the answer to our trivia question. Again, the last Senate Majority Leader to be defeated for re-election, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Bill is on the line from New Britain in Connecticut.
Hello.
Hi. Nice to have a listener in Hardware City. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm thinking about this, and I think I have it totally wrong, because I was thinking Tom Daschle, but he was a majority leader. I guess he was minority at the time, right?
He had been majority leader at one time, but at the time he was defeated, Ken?
And when he was defeated by John Thune, he was minority leader. So the caller knew the answer before he gave it. So he's not correct, but he's correct in his assumption.
No.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks very much. Let's see if we can go next to Mark, and Mark's calling from Baltimore.
Yeah, I believe it's whoever Barry Goldwater beat in 52. I think Noland, maybe?
Well, it's not Noland, but you are right with this answer. The guy that Barry Goldwater defeated in 1952 was Ernest McFarland. McFarland was the last Senate Majority Leader to be defeated. So none has been defeated since 52. Harry Reid, if he loses next year, would be the first.
Well, we have the correct answer here from JT via email, so I guess we've got a split decision. He's got Ernest McFarland. Did he get the first name right?
Well, Ernest McFarland is the guy, but the caller, of course, did know it was the guy that Goldwater defeated.
Well, we asked for the name.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to give away. All right, Mark, you get a T-shirt.
All right.
All right, Mark, we're going to put you on hold, and JT, you get a T-shirt, too, for getting the answer right.
Wait, do I get a T-shirt? Because I knew the answer.
No, you don't get a T-shirt.
Sorry.
All right, let's see. There is a contest. Mark, I'm going to put you on hold. There's a contest underway for mayor of New York City.
Well, I don't know if there's a contest
anymore.
Well,
that's the point. Mayor Bloomberg had the city charter changed so he could run for a third term. And, well, his opponents have been dropping like flies.
He's already spent like $17 million, and already we're still, months away from any kind of a primary. It looks like he may run as an independent. The Republicans seem to be in line with Michael Bloomberg, who was a Democrat all his life, became a Republican to run for mayor in 2001, reelected as a mayor as a Republican in 2005, and now is an independent. Anthony Weiner, the congressman from Brooklyn, who ran 4 years ago, would love to have run again and they're planning to run again. He said, look, I can't compete with this money, so I'm not going to run. He had an op-ed in today's New York Times saying it's just ridiculous. It's a fruitless effort to try to beat somebody with all that money.
Also that he could do more good for his city serving in Congress.
Well, until he runs for mayor 4 years from now.
There you go. Across the river in New Jersey, there's a contest underway for governor. And here's an ad by one of the rivals of the sitting governor, John Corzine. This is an ad for Chris Christie.
Over the past decade, John Corzine has spent over $100 million to get elected, attacking everyone in his path. We've seen it before. Spend enough on negative ads and maybe we'll ignore the governor's record of high taxes, tremendous debt, and failed leadership. But we know better. First, we'll slash waste and reduce spending, then cut taxes across the board and grow our economy and make New Jersey affordable again. I'm Chris Christie. Want to change Trenton? Let's start by changing governors.
And the governor then, of course, in his ads, well, has taken a bit of a high road.
He saw the crisis coming, so he got to work, generating 40,000 jobs by investing now in roads, schools, and clean energy. A $3,000 grant for every new job businesses create, freezing property taxes for seniors, cutting state spending by $5 billion. He created the nation's first economic recovery plan, so New Jersey will come back sooner and stronger. Governor Corzine, working every day to keep New Jersey working.
Can we get a contest where Bloomberg runs against Corzine? They must be the two richest politicians in the country.
It's unbelievable. And one of them is in trouble and the other one isn't. Of course, Chris Christie, the former U.S. attorney in New Jersey, does have a primary on June 2nd with a conservative, Steve Lonergan, a former mayor of Bergen County. But ultimately, we think it's going to be Christie versus Corzine. Corzine finds himself in trouble, which is unusual for a Democrat in a very blue state.
Ken Rudin, stay with us. We're going to talk about the politics of the confirmation process in just a moment when we come back. Former White House Chief of Staff Ken Duberstein will join us to give his 10 commandments for a Supreme Court nominee. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's The Political Junkie on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And I'll defend until the end the old red, white, and blue. I want to grow up to be a politician and take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's Wednesday, Political Junkie Day. Ken Rudin is with us. When President Obama introduced his nominee for the Supreme Court yesterday, many conservative groups were ready with a response. Sonia Sotomayor still faces Senate confirmation hearings and tough questions from Republicans, but she is already a target for conservative groups.
Here's Judge Sotomayor in her own published words. Our experiences as women and people of color affect our decisions. I would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life. Whether born from experience or inherent physiological or cultural differences, our gender and national origins may and will make a difference in our judging. Personal experiences affect the facts that judges choose to see. So, what is she saying?
Court of Appeals is where policy is made. And I know this is on tape and I should never say that.
Equal justice under law or under attack. America deserves better.
That's an online ad from a group called the Judicial Confirmation Network. The work now gets underway for Sotomayor. Beyond the scenes, the nominee will meet one-on-one with key senators in advance of her confirmation hearing later this summer. Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York has been selected to introduce Sotomayor to other senators and shepherd her through the nomination process. Our next guest knows from shepherding. Ken Duberstein helped guide then-nominees Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, David Souter, and Clarence Thomas when they were nominated to the High Court. He also served as President Reagan's chief of staff. He's written an article for the Daily Beast, My Inside Tips for Sonia, and joins us now from his office here in Washington, D.C. And thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Neil, my pleasure to be with you.
And, of course, we want to hear from listeners, too. What game-changing moments have you seen during previous Supreme Court confirmation processes? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. 855. You can also drop us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. And Ken Duberstein, right off the bat, you write that, quote, unless she is found to be an axe murderer or a secret Red Sox fan, Sotomayor will very likely be confirmed. Let's get that set up right from the start.
I think the rollout by President Obama has been absolutely impeccable. She seems like a natural. Obviously, the Senate is going to look at her record quite carefully, as they should. But absent, as I wrote, being an axe murderer or a Red Sox fan living in the shadow of Yankee Stadium, I think she is going to be on the bench by the first Monday in October.
If she also follows your Ten Commandments for the confirmation process, and you begin by saying something, well, that she's already started to do, and that is tell her personal story.
Look, it is absolutely compelling that she grew up poor in the South Bronx in New York City. It is similar to what we did with Clarence Thomas, growing up in Pinpoint, Georgia, without indoor plumbing, on the wrong side of the tracks. Or Bob Gates, not a Supreme Court nominee, but when he was up for CIA director, and he was known as a faceless bureaucrat. And he painted himself in his opening statement as somebody who arrived in Washington with all his belongings in the back seat of his Mustang convertible. The American people like personal stories, stories of people who come up from the bottom, people who have struggled during a lifetime and have made it big. That is what they're going to do, the personal story, the narrative of Judge Sotomayor. That is what I think sells to the American people.
You also recommend that she begin her courtesy calls, the visits with the senators, immediately, and then go on to say, practice, practice, practice. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's something inside every White House during every Supreme Court nomination called a murder board. It is a mock hearing where people throw questions at the nominee. These are not softball questions. These are the hard-edged questions to anticipate what senators may do. And sometimes people play different roles. I remember in the David Souter nomination, in the mock hearing, we had somebody play Senator Kennedy, who at that time was a leading member of the Judiciary Committee. We had somebody play Joe Biden, who was chairman of the Judiciary Committee. The harder the questions in the mock hearing, the easier the confirmation usually is.
And you point out that Robert Bork, didn't think this was important.
Judge Bork, from all the people who participated in that preparation, thought that mock hearings, that murder boards were unnecessary, and yet I don't think he was fully prepared for the kind of hazing and razzing and in-depth questions and tough scrutiny that he received during the Judiciary Committee, some of which could have been ameliorated during the murder board process.
We're talking with former White House Chief of Staff Ken Duberstein about the Ten Commandments of the confirmation process. What moments have you noticed in past confirmations where candidates have either come off the rails or greased the wheels to confirmation? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Raymond is on the line. Raymond calling from Waterford in Michigan.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
As I was telling the screener, the one that really sticks out with me is the Clarence Thomas fiasco. I could not believe that he actually made it through the confirmation hearings.
Clarence Thomas, I think, had 75 votes lined up on his behalf. And then, Anita Hill made her charges. The hearings were reopened, Ken Duberstein.
Well, the White House count was 77 for Judge Thomas before the allegations by Anita Hill. Then you had those nationally televised hearings that captivated the country, where both of them told their sides of the story, and the Senate in its wisdom confirmed Clarence Thomas by a vote of 52-48. But there were several defining moments during that testimony from Clarence Thomas that really made the difference that where he eked out his victory.
I think high-tech lynching may have been the line that people remember.
That is among the others. Yeah. Yeah, correct.
Ken?
Ken, in your article, you talk about that you're complaining that too many of these confirmation fights became political campaign attacks. And you mentioned Bork, Thomas, Souter, Roberts, and Alito. Now, all five of those guys are Republicans. Is it that the Democrats are better at dealing with confirmation politics, or do the Republicans just nominate poorer candidates?
Well, I think it is just the nature of the confirmation hearings themselves now. And remember, even though you had Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg, most of the fireworks in the court have been from Republican presidents and Republican nominees over the last 20 years. But it is not who they appoint. It is much more the nature of the battle. You know, years ago, confirmation hearings for Supreme Court judges took a half hour, took an hour. And now they have all the attributes of a political campaign.
Scalia was approved without a dissenting vote.
But there was an awful lot of, from the far left and the far right, an awful lot of ads prior to that vote.
Do you anticipate that kind of thing this time around?
Oh, I anticipate there being a lot of heat. But ultimately, it looks to me like unless there is something out there that none of us know, she will be confirmed before the first Monday in October.
Another of your commandments is to tell the truth, and to tell the truth. Evidence, again, not a Supreme Court nominee, but Bernard Kerik, who was being up for Homeland Security, Director of Homeland Security. Well, he's now facing charges, indicted yesterday on charges of lying to White House officials vetting him for that job.
Yeah, but I also say, remember that shoveling doesn't work because senators, based on their previous experience, can spot shoveling a mile away. So you got to be absolutely straight in your testimony and don't embellish.
Ken?
Another question. Sotomayor, if confirmed, she will replace David Souter, who is kind of part of the liberal bloc. If it were a conservative or a moderate conservative retiring, would there be more of a confirmation fight, do you think?
If there was a change on the balance of the court, there would be much more of a holy war than I think there will be.
Another point you make in your piece in the Daily Beast is basically from now on, say nothing to the media.
The first words that Judge Sotomayor should utter publicly should be to the Senate Judiciary Committee in her opening statement. She will have all these courtesy calls and all these private meetings with senators. There will be photo ops. But she shouldn't answer any questions from the press, from the media, from anybody other than the United States Senate. But when the American people hear her voice next, it should be before the Senate Judiciary Committee. That is wise practice, and it's also historical.
Now let's get Bill on the line, and Bill's with us from San Jose in California.
Yes, I was wondering if you think that she might encounter any resistance from Democrats, given the fact that she has a record of undermining free speech, and she might even be poised to undermine Roe versus Wade.
You know, she has in her corner the best lobbyist in the world, who happens to be a very popular president called Barack Obama. I am sure that he will talk with whoever in the United States Senate, especially Democrats, that he needs to touch. So I would not worry much on the Democratic side of the aisle.
Do you think that might cost Barack Obama in terms of, some political capital with Democrats?
I think he is going to be focusing a lot of his energy on the economy, on education, on health care, and on the environment. And yet he will find time to make sure that from his side of the aisle, this confirmation goes along smoothly.
Well, Bill's question also raises some points. Judge Sotomayor is not the champion that many on the extreme left would have hoped for, someone they would argue that they need to balance Justice Scalia. And in a way, does not that help her in the United States Senate?
I think it all spells a confirmation before the first Monday in October on both sides of the aisle.
Bill, thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
And Ken Duberstein, we know you've got an appointment. We appreciate your time today.
I hope that helps.
Appreciate
it. And let's look forward to the hearings.
We'll be there.
All right.
Ken Duberstein served as the chief of staff to President Ronald Reagan and was involved in being the shepherd to several Supreme Court nominees as they took their candidacies through the Senate Judiciary Committee and on to serve for the United States Supreme Court. He joined us today from his office here in Washington, D.C. We're on with Ken Rudin, our political junkie, who's with us every Wednesday here. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And, of course, I have to mention that Ken writes a blog that you can read every week at, every day.
My God.
By God, yeah. It's spreading every day at npr.org. And I wonder, as we look ahead to these Sotomayor hearings, there are a lot of code words that we're going to be hearing. Some of them we're hearing already that, radical liberal, but also that the word empathy has been used to attack her. That's a word that President Obama used when he outlined his qualifications for the court.
Well, conservatives are nervous that she may be, or at least they expect or they fear that she could even judge from the court, make rulings from the court, interpret the laws from the court. There's a big difference between Republicans who have to face voters and certainly have to face, as Chuck Schumer said, the wrath of women and Hispanics if they vote against them, and conservative activists who want to make this an ideological fight, who want to make this us against them to their benefit, obviously. But Republican senators seem to be caught in that little bind. How far to go in opposing her?
Jennifer's calling. Jennifer's from St. Louis.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Go ahead, please.
I was wondering whether anybody had thought about could Barack Obama have nominated Sotomayor because she's slightly more controversial, but she's replacing a liberal justice, so that he can save up somebody who's less colorful, less outspoken for when he has to replace a conservative justice.
If he gets that opportunity, Ken.
Well, I think that's exactly. I think Jennifer's point is very, very important in that if an Anthony Kennedy, it seems like it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg and John Paul Stevens, the justices who may be the next to leave. But if a conservative or a moderate were to go, I would think that Obama would get somebody more centrist, perhaps, and less controversial, although I don't think Sotomayor is that controversial compared to who he could have picked, but somebody certainly less controversial and less of a Senate fight if the ideological makeup of the court would be changed.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer. And let's go next to Steve. And Steve with us from Canton, Michigan. Steve, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
How's it going?
All right.
I was wondering, what has changed in the last few years that these votes are kind of close now? I was looking at the last votes in, the 70s and the 80s, and they were all just total landslides. And we're talking about this being, a close vote. It seems in the past it's been, a bipartisan issue when it comes to, voting in Supreme Court justice. And I was just wondering what's changed in the last few years. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, Steve, thank you.
Well, I guess the big thing was the Bork hearings of 87, and a lot of it was Robert Bork's track record. In the years since Bork, presidents have picked somebody without a paper trail, somebody you could almost get through without any controversy. Anthony Scalia is one of the most conservative Supreme Court justices in the history of the court, and yet in 1986, when he was confirmed, there was not a single member of the Senate to vote against him. But 87, that changed with the Bork hearings. Then, of course, that changed with the John Tower confirmation hearings as Secretary of Defense in 89.
Yes.
And since then, it's been more of an ideological battle. Republicans also noticed that when President Clinton named Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer in 93 and 94, there was not the ideological battles that went on in the past. So they have to decide whether they want to refight the old, us versus them battles or pick and choose their openings.
Well, you mentioned there were attempts, failed, but attempts to mount filibuster the last couple of times around. But in the end, both Sam Alito and Chief Justice Roberts were overwhelmingly approved.
True, but 42 senators voted against Sam Alito, and that's pretty much more than the average when I think Sandra Day O'Connor, zero Anthony Kennedy, I think zero of opposition. It's become more of a political trial in the latter years.
Well, obviously a subject that we will be revisiting in the weeks and months to come. The hearings are expected to be in July, with at least the White House hopes that there will be a vote in the United States Senate before the Congress goes on its August recess, its summer vacation, and thereby that a Justice Sotomayor would be in place in September to begin participating in the court. It may drag into September. We have yet to see that. Ken Rudin, as always, thanks very much.
Thanks, Neil.
Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and our political junkie, joins us here every Wednesday on Talk of the Nation. Coming up, North Korea tests a nuclear bomb and fires off several short-range missiles. Why and why now? We'll try to decipher the messages from Pyongyang. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.